in by 2014. At every single one of those, in reading, no matter whether you have, whether these are, is it School of the Blind or if it's socially impaired or whatever, they all have to be equally proficient by that time in all of those, or they haven't done any. Is that right?
Through the chair, you've raised an interesting piece, and it's one of those details that we'll get to when we do our peer review process. How to handle these special population schools or the special population programs is an area where there appears to be some flexibility. Right now, what we've done is we had a school that, based on the population that they serve and the mission that they have, it would appear to be very difficult for them to be able to achieve those goals in that kind of a timeline. And so we've written, and we're still waiting for response about, so what happens next? So on a specific, I've got to say, those are the things we're still dealing with them on. But your larger question about, it is the goal, it is the stated goal, it's the very explicit, that they're talking about all kids at 100% proficiency in the areas of reading and math. The flexibility that a state has is how it defines proficiency is one of those. And you'll remember from some of the articles that came out during the summer, the fear that the USED was expressing that some states might lower down their definition of what proficiency to make that a bar that would be achievable. And the Secretary of Ed saying, I don't want to see you doing that. Proficient's proficient, and you ought to have all your kids reaching there. We looked at this last year when I was, I think, with this committee, when we were talking about the, we had reviewed our kids' math achievement in our, against our benchmarks, and then looked at our math achievement against the norm reference tests. You know, norm reference test says how kids do against other kids, and the benchmark tests say how do our kids do against our standards. And we found, for instance, in one of those, in math at the eighth grade, that our kids were not achieving to where we had set the bar, even though that the norm reference test showed that those showed that the kids in the grades above and below, and thus we believe those kids, were at a very high level, 65th percentile. It would indicate that we had set a very high bar. We had set a very high definition for what proficient would mean. That could come back to haunt us. In one regard, as parents, we might say it's really good to set that bar high for the kids. But if, on the other hand, when you set that bar high for the kids and now there's going to be that kind of accountability where failure to make it puts you on some sort of a school improvement list, it might make a state want to go back and revisit. Is that really what we want to call proficient? And those are some of the unintended consequences that I think we all want to avoid.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, if I might, there are some key pieces that I want to get. I don't want to run over time, though.
Representative Stevens has a question.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I'll make it very quick, Madam Chair. That's a nice ring, Madam Chair, by the way. I'm trying to deal with the issue of the English as a second language and the students who lots of districts get a lot of ESL students. Now, what happens to them? Eventually, they move out into another category. And they're replaced by kids who move into the district without any proficiency in English. How can you ever win if they keep replacing each other?
This was, through the chair, thank you. This was one of those specifics that process I made reference to earlier, that group that had gone to Washington to meet and confer and advise, that we had identified and that had been a topic in our state and some other states. It appears to be a you can't win for playing if indeed the LEP group, the limited English proficient group, as soon as you get somebody proficient, by definition, they're no longer limited English proficient, and theoretically they'd be moved on, and you would say that was a success, but you're still being measured against the kids that are left, which are, by definition, those that are not proficient, or they wouldn't be LEP. We proposed, and were told initially that it didn't get there, that for purposes of accountability, that we'd be able to monitor, be able to continue recording those kids in some category so that we can indeed, so that schools can indeed get credit, if you will, be seen as having made progress. A couple of the states, as it turns out, if I understand correctly, Mark, correct me if I'm wrong here, a couple of the states in their plans do have something that appears to allow for that monitoring. That'll be an item that we'll be discussing in our peer review, because if we don't, it does look very difficult. It looks like you can't, by definition, get there. Am I correct, Mark? There are a couple.
Yes, in our plan, we're proposing to identify LEP students as students who are served or who have ever been served in the program. And I don't know if that'll pass peer review, but some other states then built in a monitoring time, so like a 3-year monitoring time for the student after they've been reclassified.
Thank you. The on page 17, you'll see the phrase compensatory versus conjunctive. Again, this is to prepare you for your conversations on Thursday. Everybody agrees we should have multiple indicators. The state plan envisioned what we call compensatory. That is, you look at the whole picture, and if you've got the overall picture looks good, then you can take some of this stuff over here and, in effect, compensate for what might be an underperformance somewhere else, not to excuse the underperformance, but simply to say a full picture. The Fed's plan is a conjunctive system, which is just another way of saying you got to make each and every cell. And as we look, if you have all the grade levels and they're disaggregated by the various ethnic groups, and you have to make in each of those ethnic groups in both reading and math, and make your graduation rate by each of those ethnic groups, and make your participation rate by each ethnic group, what you in effect have, and by your special ed population and your LEP population and your Title I population, in effect what you've done is greatly multiplied the opportunities for not making it. And if you don't make it in any one cell, again, you don't make it. And that is a problem. It's not a problem for the individual kid. It is a problem for the system identification. And one of our cautions is not that we don't want those issues to be worked on, but if you end up with a system, if we were to end up with a system that basically identified the overwhelming numbers of our schools, then we've lost the tool to be able to target those that really need the help and the assistance. So that compensatory versus conjunctive. We wanted to figure out a way, a system that would include small schools. The feds, one of the areas of flexibility was to say that we'll give you the flexibility for how you want to do it, but you have to do it, and you've got to have reliable and valid numbers. We have that you base it on. You can't use small numbers. So we have 135 schools that have 50 or less kids. We have 85 schools that have 25 or less kids. That's a significant number. We have a little bit over 500 schools total, so we're talking 20%, 120% of 500. That's too large a number simply to either not include or, as the Fed system would say, roll them up. But as we made it clear to the feds, our system, our state, wants to see accountability at each and every school level. So we were building a system that would allow us to be able to look at those individual schools. It wasn't good enough for us to simply roll those up because we wanted to get down to what was happening at the school level. We think we've come up with some answers by looking at something called a confidence band. Again, for the sake of time, I just want to say it's a statistical way that allows us to look at smaller numbers than might otherwise be acceptable and still be able to say something about them, so that if you've got a very small school, 8, 10, 12 kids in your testing pool, and none of them are anywhere near proficient, then even though that's a small number, and that happens over a couple of years, then we can begin to feel pretty comfortable about saying that school's got a problem that needs to be addressed. And confidence band allows us to say that. Whereas if you've got 20 and they're all just at that cusp, then maybe that's not a big enough number for us to make that kind of definitive statement. Maybe we do need to take some more time. So we want to be able to make those sort of discriminations. And again, Mark will be more than able to describe how that works in some more detail. It is a little bit complicated. We spent a lot of time talking to the technical review committee because It's not going to be very simple to understand, but it's the only way we've been able to figure that we can meet the larger goal of addressing all schools and still get those small schools in there. So we do want to spend some time with you. At this point, it'd be enough. I've met my goal. If you understand that we've got that on our radar, we think we've got a solution. We'll be talking to the feds and their number of people about it. But it's our best shot at making sure we've got that. The same thing here, the comment about the special mission school. We think we've got some ways to handle the school that by definition is a dropout prevention or is a special education center, that we think that we need some allowances, and so we built that into our system, and we'll be talking with them about it. And as you're talking with Ken Myers, again, that might be a kind of a question to ask him about. We think this is very important. Schools with no grade level tested, we think we've got a solution. The feds have mandated testing at 3 through 9th, and then one at 10 through 12th, but we do have K-2 schools. And they've said that those K-2s must be included in the assessment system, in the accountability system, but there's not a a specific test. And so we have had to come up with how to do that. Page 18 is a revisit of a point we made earlier. We've been talking about how to address inconsistent requirements, state and local control, as was pointed out by a couple of the representatives and by myself. This is an issue, regardless of how you feel about it, whether you think this is, whether one feels this is well overdue or not, we all need to know this is a new role for the feds. It's a new level of involvement in local and state matters. And then policy needs to be developed about, so how does that look? And then I think my perspective is you all would have things to say about this, and the community's going to have things to say about this, the details that were given. So we're looking at growth calculation. This should all be, hopefully now as you're seeing these for the second time around, you're going to be thinking, I know what this is about. So we talked about the growth versus status. We talked about the subgroups. The issue of N size will be something that on Thursday we'll be talking about. N is just a academician's way of talking about the size of the group. The N is the number. Full academic year. Every state has had to define what a full academic year looks like, and so for us, programmatically, we're going to be looking at kids that are enrolled for the count and kids that are still there for the test. It seemed to be a very makes sense sort of a solution. Any of you that serve on committees know how long it takes to come to those kind of decisions. Graduation rate, we had to define that. I could continue with these detailed pieces, but we are near the end, and I wanted to leave some time for any questions that you all might have for me at this time.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My understanding is that the I referred to it for a long time as the ESEA is over 1,100 pages.
Yes.
No pictures. It's just asking an enormous task for you to come here and make even there's no time to deal with this issue. And that's only one part of the issues that we have to deal with. So I'm hopeful that you can distill it down, and maybe we could keep the questions short and brief to enable us to understand this. Are we going to have another opportunity? Because I'm not reading 1,100 pages.
Well, we are going to, believe me, he has boiled this down. Believe me, this has been boiled down several times already, so we will have plenty of time to get to it and deal with it, but we do want to get on with what we have to present today so that we can kind of have an overview of everything before we tackle it. I really hate to have anybody ask any questions, because we do want to get through, I'm sorry, we will have time eventually, but let's get through it today so that we can kind of just get it fed to us one time before we start regurgitating it.
If you would then look at page 20, and page 20 is a big picture before I bring Mr. Mattson up here to join us to talk about highly qualified teachers, highly qualified paraprofessionals, and school improvement plans. Accountability system has three pieces, and what we have been dealing with so far on your slide 20, I'm sorry, not page 20, slide 20, my apologies. What we've been dealing with really is that identification system. what we really need and what I've been asking the department staff to look at is the interventions. So what do you do with the information? Because to make this work, it's got to be more than just a better yardstick. It's got to be more than just a brighter goalpost. And so the three pieces, identification, that we have accurate and reliable and public understandable indicators, that we've got a system of the so what do schools, what do districts, what does the state do about those schools that are underperforming and those schools that are performing real well, because we do think there are some models out there, and if we can get those models out there promoted and work in other places. And then finally, the third piece, any big intervention does need the evaluation. Does the intervention that's put in place work? It's kind of like the cycle back, so that we do see increased student achievement. And the concern that we have is we very appropriately are making sure the identification system is clean and good and appropriate. But I would not want to lose this opportunity to point out that is only one part of this three-piece system, intervention and evaluation. All of that has to do with the assessment and the accountability piece. The bill has 9 parts. That was the first part. The chapters 2 and on are not as big, but they are. There is real antsiness about as we move into these next pieces, because we do get into the so what happens, and also get into the issue of our teachers being highly qualified and aides being highly qualified, and all of the very legitimate concern that's going on around that. So what I would like to do, Madam Chair, with your permission, is to ask Dr. Mattson to come up. He's been our chief go-to person on this next section.
Okay.
Will that work? Eric?
Thank you. For the record, my name is Eric Mattson. I am the Title I Administrator of the Department of Education and Early Development. Madam Chairman, members of the committees. There are really two sections that I'd like to try to go through. I guess I've always thought that 90 minutes is about as long as a human being can sit still, and we're already at that edge, so I'll do the best I can to keep moving on this. There are really two sections that we need to look at. One is the school improvement section, and the other is what's sometimes lumped as the highly qualified section, but that applies both to paraprofessionals and to certificated teachers. I really can't begin any presentation without reiterating what the Deputy Commissioner pointed out, that there's a dilemma for us between the intent and the implementation of this law. The intent is something that we absolutely agree with. There's no question but what we need to do a better job, particularly with low socioeconomic students. What we've done is not acceptable. But at the same time, the implementation strategies that are being proposed are sometimes causing some real heartburn for Alaska. School improvement has several pieces. We might categorize them as the overall sequence, the issue of choice, and the issue of supplemental educational services. And I apologize that I wasn't aware that when this was to be printed for you, that it would be printed with 3 slides to a sheet rather than 2. On 2, you can actually almost see the lines. And that's unfortunate, because that chart really summarizes all of the points. Maybe the best thing to do is not to dwell on it for a long time, but I would point out that when people talk about school improvement, you will sometimes hear 3 numbers associated with any given year. And all of those numbers are correct. It's just a sort of a different way of visualizing it. So, for example, down in the third row, if you can see that, the school in it.
Which slide?
21?
That would be the one with the chart.
24.
Yeah, it's the one that makes your eyes go blah, blah, blah.
That's the only one that will have to face that. I'm sorry for that.
I will have that printed out so that we have it. We'll have it in our packets by next time. So
this issue of the numbers that are associated with any given year, if a school is in its first year of improvement status, so there's your one number, it's already missed adequate yearly progress for 2 consecutive years. And if you're looking at those first if you're considering the whole sequence, then it would be in the third year of the overall sequence. So when people use different numbers, it's not that they're incorrect or wrong. It's just that they're visualizing this in a different way. If a school does not make adequate yearly progress, then it moves into the different levels of status. And let's not spend too much time in that chart because, unfortunately, you can't see it right now. But looking at the next slide, mentioned that this doesn't begin until a school has not made adequate yearly progress for 2 years. So let's look at point number two. Each year that a school is in status, it would continue all of the remedies that it has had to implement so far, plus new ones for each successive year. Once it's in status, if a school makes AYP for 1 year, it goes into what you might call a holding pattern. That is, that it doesn't introduce any new remedies. It must continue to offer the ones that have been offered so far, and you wait and see what happens. If the school does make adequate yearly progress for the second year, then it exits school improvement status and just becomes a normal, healthy school like we like to see them all. If it does not make adequate yearly progress, then it continues in school improvement status and adds the new remedies that would be appropriate to that level. In order for a school to exit status, it makes adequate yearly progress for 2 years. There are a couple of things here that we might mention. I hope my slide is somewhat different for you. There are technically the way the law was originally written, in the first year in status, a school choice, that is transportation for choice, was required to be offered. However, we know that in most communities in Alaska, that's simply not realistic, whether it was because of our protestations or other states, I don't know. But the regulations and the guidance that came out after the statute that was written essentially collapsed choice and supplemental services together, supplemental services being the remedy in the second year. So that now we have both the challenge but also the flexibility to use whichever of those seems to make most sense in the particular setting. And I really believe that that's going to be an advantage for Alaska. We'd move to the next slide, talking about the third year in status. I probably won't go through those, but as you can see from the next two slides, in the third year, a school is said to begin corrective action. That's be the third year in status after not making adequate yearly progress. That would be for 5 years, but 4 years by that time. In the fourth year in status, you begin to plan for alternative governance. And in the fifth year in status, actually begin alternative governance. As you can see by just simply scanning through those remedies, those are places we don't want to go. We'd like to find ways to help schools to provide the assistance and the supports to turn things around before we ever get there. We don't want to talk about replacing staff or reopening the school in some other format, those kinds of things. But that is what the law requires if we get to that stage. The next slide, districts with schools in school improvement status must spend an amount equal to 20% of their Title I-A allocation for this choice and supplemental service combination, unless a smaller amount is needed to fulfill all of the requests. The amount equal to language is important because a district may take those funds from any source that's available, state or federal source that's available to it, presumably a private contribution. But so the language sets the amount, but not where it must be taken from. There is a certain amount of flexibility within the law. Funds can be moved from most of the titles into Title I, but cannot be moved out of Title I. So they could also be taken from those other federal titles. I mentioned the choice and supplemental services were combined, so let's skip past that then. In order for a school to be offered to parents as a choice, there are three criteria. The school must be public, it must be within the child's school district, and it must not itself be in improvement status. It's important to note that the language for this particular provision says that the funding is for transportation for choice. It is not for boarding or for tuition or for any other expenses that may be associated with that. So. Briefly, the criteria that describe supplemental educational services, they must be outside the normal school day. Districts, for-profits, and non-profits are eligible to apply. We did get something back from the U.S. Department saying that it would be state discretion as to whether entities would be allowed to hold a business license, which is a very different thing, as you know, from actually becoming incorporated. And it seems to us that makes sense because we do want to have as many local community and regionally based groups participate as possible, so that would be our intention. The purpose of the set-aside is to provide direct services to students. This has caused a bit of confusion because sometimes districts will want to buy additional equipment. They may want to buy assessment tools or other devices that are going to help make to assist teachers, but that, and those may be very good things to do. They just simply cannot come from this particular source of funding. We now have two approved supplemental education service providers, both of which have agreed to provide services to all of the sites currently in status. That's not nearly enough. We need to have more to make to offer parents true choice. I do need to note that we've been very disappointed in the applications we've received so far. They showed a very low level of awareness of the communities and the students that they were going to be serving, which is disheartening. And so far, we have not received any applications from regional or community-based groups, which we hope very much will be a part of the picture as we go along. A couple of points in regard to choice and supplemental services that the department has tried to suggest to districts. We have said that it just simply does not make sense to require districts to offer choice that involves unreasonable transportation. And by unreasonable, I mean flying children out in the morning and flying them back in the evening. The department has concurred that just is not, that's off the table. Districts are not going to be forced to do that. So the same thing with forced boarding. Now, none of that is to prevent a parent and a willing sending district and a willing receiving district from cooperating to set up an arrangement, but they're not going to be required to do so. As Deputy Commissioner McLean indicated a minute ago, the department has been in very extensive conversations, not only with the U.S. Department, but with other potential providers and people who might provide these services. We've talked extensively with districts about which of those match their needs. So far, the response from districts seems to be that they're thinking about it and they're trying to sort out what they see as their real needs and how those match up with the services that are offered. That's not a process that we can continue very long because the law says that we need to be offering those services immediately. So we are encouraging them to do that. There are two parent notification requirements with regard to school improvement. One is just informing parents what school improvement status is, that a site has entered into school improvement status, and the meaning of that in terms of what their options are, how to exercise those options. It's important to note that throughout this, that the emphasis is very clearly on parental choice. A district in regard to supplemental services plays a facilitating role. That is, that it would let parents know what the law says, let parents know what service providers are available, what areas they're offering service in, but it is the parent that chooses, and then the district writes the contract and facilitates the process in terms of, for example, tracking whether there's actually a difference being made in students' achievement scores. A number of things that we as a state are facing with regard to choice and supplemental services, and that is to continue to identify supports and strategies and rewards that will help schools that are in status. We need to devise choice and supplemental education service processes that will be appropriate and effective in our particular settings. As you know, that they are in many ways at least quite different from most other communities, if not unique. We need to figure out, as I believe Representative Stevens asked about a minute ago, ways to address heritage language issues within the context of a federal law that requires English language proficiency and moreover requires testing in English by the third grade. We see those issues as being interrelated. You're not going to be able to address one set of issues without addressing the other. They're very much part and parcel of each other. We're going to need how to either work within or, if possible, amend a law that prescribes removing staff as one of the remedies when, as I gather from the audience and members of the committee reacted before, we all pretty much agree that turnover is one of our problems. It is not a solution. Somehow we need to increase our capacity to attract and train as educators people who are already resident in the communities and therefore likely to stay there and to continue to serve those communities. And certainly, as does the rest of the nation, we need to figure out ways to develop strategies to attract and retain the most highly qualified teachers into our students, into our schools that are struggling. Now, our most qualified teachers tend to go to the student to the schools that are not struggling, and that's not a situation that's going to offer very much hope. Madam Chair, would you prefer that we stop briefly? This is the end of the first section. Would you like to entertain questions? Do you want me to?
No, we really need to go because we don't have very much time.
We'll do that. The next topic that we'd like to look at for just a few minutes is the whole issue of how teachers and paraprofessionals become highly qualified. With paraprofessionals, the law refers to minimum qualifications rather than actually being highly qualified. Those minimum qualifications are a high school diploma or a recognized equivalent, and one of the items in under number two, either 2 years of college or an associate's degree or a passing score on what the law refers to as a rigorous formal state or local assessment.
Is this for the certified teachers or classified teachers? Is this for the aides?
Madam Chair, Representative Kapsner, no, this is for paraprofessionals.
Not the regular teachers, the aides. Yeah.
Okay.
Well, we sometimes refer to as instructional aides.
Okay.
The timeline with regard to paraprofessionals, this law was somewhat different than the others we've seen before, and that is that some of the major provisions took effect on the day the law was signed. So all paraprofessionals that were hired into Title I positions after January 8th, the day of signing, had to meet the minimum qualifications. That essentially, districts were put under a hiring freeze. I'll address that in a minute, how we've attempted to somewhat ameliorate the effects of that. As of this summer, all paraprofessionals supported by Title I funds, regardless of date of hire, had to have the high school diploma. And looking 4 years out, all paraprofessionals, regardless of date of hire, must meet both parts of those requirements, that is the diploma and the college experience or associate degree. We can move on then to certificated teachers. I do need to point out to you that the whole issue of becoming highly qualified and what a highly qualified teacher is a federal issue that came to us in the No Child Left Behind Act. That's very different from certification and endorsement issues, which are state issues. Obviously, we need to bring those into line with each other very quickly, but for the time being, we do need to remember that those are separate sets of requirements that teachers are subject to. The requirements for teachers vary by date of hire and grade level taught and a number of other things. I tried to distill this down so that we could hit the high points today. Basically, to be considered highly qualified, all teachers must have earned a bachelor's degree and have full state certification. So emergency certification, provisional certifications, those types of things do not count in their view. There's one that we think we may be able to fit appropriately in there, but the others do not. Plus what the U.S. Department refers to as a demonstration of competence. In our Alaska Department, we have tended to refer more to additional requirements simply because going to an experienced teacher who's been doing a good job for 12 or 15 years and saying, now you must demonstrate that you're competent, doesn't seem like a very respectful way to begin the conversation. So we tend to use this alternative phrasing. New elementary teachers must take this rigorous test in reading, writing, math, and other areas of the basic elementary curriculum, which we assume means other topics typically taught in an elementary school. New elementary teachers have no option. That is the only way by which they can become highly qualified. New middle and secondary teachers have the subject area test simply because at the middle and secondary level, you have a content that you were assigned to teach, and so there's a subject that you can be tested in. Elementary teachers do not have that. That's why you see the difference there. They also have the option of either coming out of college or after college acquiring a major or equivalent coursework or a graduate degree in each of the subject areas they teach. So for example, if a teacher teaches two periods of three different, one of social studies and one of math and one of history, then that person would have to have a major or an advanced degree or take a test in each one of those subject areas. I think you can imagine what this means for some of our very small schools. If you intend to offer a full secondary curriculum and have two or perhaps three certificated teachers, how many majors can we require each of those teachers to hold in order to meet the law? That's a challenge. Experienced elementary teachers do have one additional option in addition to the test, which is also available to them, and that's what the law refers to as a high objective uniform state standard of evaluation. And the law specifies seven criteria that that evaluation must meet. They're rather dry, so with your permission, I will not go into them now. Experienced middle and secondary teachers have the option of the test, or they have the option of the major or equivalent coursework, because again, at the middle and secondary levels, you have a content area, or they also have the option of the evaluation. These timelines kick in essentially for teachers at two different points. Right now, all teachers who were hired after the first day of school last fall, supported to teach core content areas supported by Title I, must meet that requirement immediately. So effectively, every new teacher that's hired now with those three provisos will have to meet the law. By 05-06, and I believe you mentioned this issue earlier, how this law affects all teachers in the state, what the feds have said to us is that if a district receives any Title I funds, whatever, then that district must have a plan through which all of the teachers who teach a core content area must become highly qualified. They said the same thing to us as a state. If a state has a district that receives any Title I funds, then on and on. So you can see how essentially the U.S. Department is using Title I funds as a lever so that eventually they have the authority to impose this requirement on all teachers in any state that receives Title I funds, basically, is what it boils down to. You have a list of the core academic subjects there. I think that we will not go into that right at the moment unless you choose to. When you have time to look at it, it's a very interesting list in terms of how it's put together. Some of those are very broad. Some of them are very specific. We have now in the state a list of teacher identification codes that tell us the specific subject areas that teachers teach in. We're trying to map these nine core content academic subject areas onto the 120 or 130 teacher assignment codes that we use to see how they relate. And we think that it's a doable task, but it has some work left to do. Regarding set-asides and parental notification specifically for this highly qualified issue, a district must use between 5% and 10%, 5% minimum, 10% maximum, to help teachers who are not highly qualified become highly qualified, and that is true for both paraprofessionals and certificated teachers. After school year 03-04, that cap is lifted so that they can spend as much as they think is necessary to meet the law. The department has a number of activities underway to try to facilitate this process. We have recommended to all districts that they allow us to proceed with their input and with a very broadly based group to develop a statewide assessment for paraprofessionals rather than having 20 or 30 or 40 or 50 individual assessments developed by districts, which the state would ultimately have to assure the U.S. Department that those are all rigorous anyway. So it seems to be a better use of time and energy to develop one that they support and that makes sense to them. Toward that end, ED is currently facilitating two broadly based work groups. Essentially, each of the work groups has been charged with identifying the test, and this will probably be a purchased instrument simply because of the complications involved in writing one, norming it, piloting it, et cetera. However, the evaluation for certificated teachers and the assessment for paraprofessionals, certainly the evaluation for teachers, will be something that we will develop in the state that will go out for peer review among administrators and teachers and whatnot, and then that will be submitted to the commissioner for disposition. She can decide what the appropriate step is from there. As you can imagine, these requirements caused quite a bit of consternation for some of our districts and for some of our sites and for some of our teachers in the state. And over the past 6 or 8 months, a set of guidances, I guess the best word is probably evolved, to help them with dealing with this. And what we said simply is continue to hire the best people available. That's all you can do. If you have a pool of two or three applicants, you have to choose the best person available. do not under any circumstances release someone that you consider to be instructionally valuable. There are all kinds of reasons why people are released. There are all kinds of reasons why they're retained. But the key one here is if it's someone who's making an instructional contribution, don't let the person go. We need people like that. And finally, if you find yourselves with a person who is not highly qualified, or if you need to hire from the small pool someone who's not, then immediately do your best to implement the law. Design a program that will identify what it is the person needs to do to become highly qualified. Use this professional development set aside to pay for the registration or tuition or whatever it may be to take the courses, and assure that the person is actually making progress. We think that's something that we can go back to the U.S. Department and say, look, this district is doing absolutely everything it can to meet the intent of the law, and we would like you to give that serious consideration. Finally, there are a couple of tasks that remain ahead of us with regard to highly qualified. One is that we need to be very careful about how we go about this task without losing sight of what's really important. And by that, I mean student achievement is what's really important. The goal is student learning. Test scores are merely the indicators that tell us whether we're getting there or not. So we don't want to go off and follow a red herring and get so caught up in the test scores that we forget what it is we're really trying to do. And as you imagine that you're aware that that's not just something that we face. I mentioned a minute ago that we need to bring the federal highly qualified requirements and the state endorsement and certification requirements into sync with each other. That is a doable task, but it's a large one and it is yet ahead of us. We need to work with universities to develop additional opportunities through which paraprofessionals can meet these requirements, particularly, this is by and large, certificated teachers have the academic portion behind them. Oftentimes, the paraprofessionals don't, which is the reason that that's worded in that way. And finally, we need to continue to explore ways to deliver high-quality instruction in these very small communities. When the No Child Left Behind Act said to us that every teacher there must hold a major or advanced credential in each of the subject areas that he or she teaches. Those two don't seem to fit very well, so we need to figure out how to do that. So with that, I will stop and thank you. I don't know whether you want to take time for questions or whether you have other business.
So is your program totally complete?
That's right? The end of this section.
I just had some closing comments to make. Yeah.
Madam Chair, I want to thank you and your committee's time and attention. We have spent time today talking about some of the particular issues and give you an overview and talk about some of the issues. But as we close this out, I did want to bring you back to those common pieces that we ended. So why No Child Left Behind? And to reinforce, we do have an achievement gap in the state. We do have some achievement issues. They need to be addressed. We don't want to shrink from that. While there are some challenges, there are some areas of real agreement. The focus on highly qualified teachers is something that none of us, I think, would question. The idea that we need to close that achievement gap is something that all of us hopefully would agree to. We do need to figure out, once we get the identification, where the resources would come from. The parents need to be notified. I think people would argue that there is a real need. Our school designator system had that built in. But there is this linkage that needs to be made. We're here to answer whatever questions, either now or later on. We'll get you copies of these handouts in the fuller piece. I do apologize for that. I was trying to put this stuff together for you, and I take responsibility, but we'll get you that in a bigger set. I should send those to you, Madam Chair, and then you would distribute them, or we can get them to the members themselves, whichever you'd prefer.
Go ahead and give them to us, and we'll put it in the next packet.
Okay. With that, I would want to close and thank you again, and any questions, be happy to answer. Thank you, Madam Chair.
That doesn't leave us very much time. I do want to mention that every state is in the same dilemma that we are. There are many states that have put in exemptions and trying to get waivers. Not one waiver has been accepted. There are many states. We kind of think Alaska is so different in that we have rural areas where we just that we have teachers, maybe two teachers in a school, things like that. I've talked with several different states and people from several different states, and their Idaho, Colorado, they're experiencing the same feelings that we are and some of the same problems. So we have a big challenge in front of us. I really think that probably at this time we'll just end, and next time we meet, we will be having somebody at the federal level here to talk to us. So that meeting will be Thursday morning, January 30th at 11 o'clock in the House Resource Room 124. And the briefing will be by Kevin Meyer, who is a liaison to the state elected officials with the U.S. Department of Education. And so this HESC committee will meet this Thursday at 3 o'clock in this room. So we're going to have a lot of time to deal with a lot of different things, and we aren't going to I guess what I want to say is I don't want you to be fearful that we aren't going to have time to chew this up, because we are. And so right now, I thank you, Deputy Commissioner, for being here, and Dr. Mattson for you coming. And we will realize that we have challenges ahead of us, but we will definitely be more up to meeting them when we understand it a little bit better. So thank you for coming, and thank you for everybody on the committee. And I'm looking at times, and I will get back to you on the times, because you haven't all gotten back to me yet on it. So we will deal with that in the next day. But anyway, thank you everyone for taking your time to be here. I appreciate it, and we will adjourn.
I thought you were earlier.